From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Tonight in Florida, President Trump will hold the first of four rallies planned for this week. His doctor said over the weekend that the president is no longer contagious with the coronavirus.
The confirmation hearings for the president's third Supreme Court nominee is also underway, and White House negotiators have resumed talks with House Democrats on a coronavirus aid bill after Trump called off talks last week. Let's look at the week ahead with Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News. And Beth, let's start with that aid bill to help people and businesses struggling financially during this pandemic. On CNN Sunday, the White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow indicated that President Trump might offer more relief money than the $2.2 trillion that House Democrats had been holding out for.
He knows that we need as much power for economic recovery as possible. It's not just recovery in 3 weeks. It's recovery to the end of the year and beyond in a possible second term.
Beth, how is he going to bring Republicans along with him if they're unhappy with a $1.8 trillion offer the White House floated on Saturday? What's likely to happen this week?
Well, it's all been so confusing, Tanya. I mean, it was just a little over a week ago that he said that he was walking away. He'd instructed his negotiators to walk away from the table and do not negotiate with Democrats on a relief package, and that there would only be a new relief plan coming along, if, as the president put it, after I win. So he was sort of hinting that basically if unemployed people wanted to see more money, they would need to see a Trump win for that to happen. And then, of course, he realized that that was perhaps a rash move, that sending relief to businesses and to unemployed Americans might actually help him ahead of the election. So he asked his team to switch gears and start advocating for a really big bill again. But look, it's not going to happen at this point, Tanya. It's too late in the process. Senate Republicans, who hold the key here, really have indicated that this is a no-go for them. Nancy Pelosi has gotten sort of disgusted with the whole process. She says she wants a big bill, that the House passed a big bill already last spring, and that the president has just been very erratic about all this. So we are unlikely to see any major legislation before the election.
Okay. President Trump is also expected to travel nearly every day until Election Day. But of course, there are lingering questions about his health. What impact are those concerns having on this race?
Well, President Trump's obviously very eager to get back out again and look as though he has conquered this virus, that he had it, but that he pushed through, and that he's a victor and that he's conquered it. That's all very much in keeping with his brand of, you know, not looking ever like he's weak or frail or human in the way that the rest of us are. The problem is for him to go out on the campaign trail now, not only probably is a bit risky because of his own health and the fact that he's still recuperating from this virus, but also potentially putting the health of many, many supporters who are going to come to the rallies at risk as well, whether it's him that might infect people or the fact that at these rallies, typically supporters show up and they do not mask and they do not socially distance, and some of them end up getting sick. So it is entirely on brand for him to be doing this, but it is also very risky.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden continues to struggle with answering the question of whether he will expand the Supreme Court if elected to protect abortion rights and the Affordable Care Act. Is that having any effect on the race in key states?
It's hard to imagine in the middle of a pandemic and an economic crisis that that topic is going to move voters significantly one way or the other. Frankly, Tanya, I really doubt people even have thought much about what the concept of court packing means and what it looks like. What ended up happening was because both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have repeatedly said they will not answer a question about that topic until after the election, they just sort of set themselves up to continue to be asked about it. I don't think it's a issue that's going to move a lot of voters, but it just means the question is still going to be put to them over and over and over.
Yeah. With the minute I have with you, I want to ask you about this as well. So over the weekend in the South Carolina Senate race, Democrat Jamie Harrison announced a $57 million fundraising haul in the third quarter of this year, really shattering a Senate record in his race against Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Lindsey Graham. Are Republicans taking that as a warning sign as they push to get Judge Coney Barrett confirmed before Election Day?
They certainly are and should be. Jamie Harrison is probably within a hair of defeating Lindsey Graham in that very conservative state of South Carolina. What we're seeing here, Tanya, is the sign that, you know, Democrats are very, very fired up to not only elect a Democratic president, but to flip the Senate and put it back into Democratic control, which is why we're seeing extraordinary fundraising, not just by Jamie Harrison, although he seems to be raising the most, but by many, many other Democratic challengers as well. So it's a sign that the energy is there. We'll just need to see if the votes are there come November 3rd.
Beth Fooey is senior politics editor at NBC News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When the World Food Program was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize on Friday, we saw yet another example of how deeply the coronavirus has affected everyday life around the world. And in this country, food banks that have seen huge increases in demand during the pandemic are bracing for another challenge: the winding down of federal coronavirus aid that has helped them keep hungry people fed. Larry Scott is chief operating officer of the Three Square Food Bank in Las Vegas. Larry, welcome.
Happy to be with you today.
And I see that you told a local news outlet that before the pandemic, you had about 270,000 food insecure people in southern Nevada. But today, now it's up to as many as 450,000 people. Remarkable. What are you seeing in Las Vegas?
Well, certainly we did see a dramatic spike in demand as the pandemic first was upon us. And then we saw it to taper a little bit and then level off. And then we've seen just kind of a gradual, steady increase in demand, which seems to be our new norm for now.
I also see that Nevada has one of the worst problems for food insecurity in the country. Why do you think that is? I mean, is it something to do with where you are, with the economy?
Well, Las Vegas is a land of opportunity. A lot of people come to Las Vegas hoping to change their life circumstances. And there are a lot of employment opportunities that aren't necessarily require high levels of education. And so it attracts people from all over the country. And so we get a lot of in-migration every single year. And as long as our economy and hospitality is going well, yeah, those people live nice lives, but when hospitality is hurt, as it is now, they suffer.
Where are you getting the food that you're serving to people? Is it from the community? Do you have to go out and buy it yourself? How's that working?
We do purchase some, but for the most part, last month, for instance, we sourced about 5.6 million pounds of food, and about 2.5 million of that was donated. Another 2.7 million of that were federal commodities, and then the balance was purchased food.
Well, I see that nationwide, the group Feeding America says that food banks in their network, like yours, are facing an 8 billion meal shortfall between now and June of next year. Are you concerned about not being able to keep up with the demand?
Without question. As I just mentioned, the numbers, we've been propped up significantly by federal commodities. But it's represented during this pandemic, it's represented as high as 45% of our food that we've sourced. And so as that goes away, we have got to find an alternative for that.
Well, now, wait a minute. Why would that be going away?
Well, they'll be taking away certain portions of it for sure. Of that 2.7 million, about 1.3 million of that has been specifically for CARES funding associated with the pandemic. And that is winding down in its funding, as well as purchasing that was being done to shore up trade challenges that we had with China. The U.S. government was purchasing food from the farmers and distributing it to needy through the food banks. And that program, too, is winding down by year's end. So it'll represent a high percentage of our federal commodities.
Well, I really don't want to make this conversation political. On the other hand, I think you just laid out a couple of reasons why,
yeah,
unfortunately,
there, so.
It is, right? I mean, no, but I you know, we've even been hearing that some food banks have had to take letters out of these boxes from the federal government that were signed by President Trump. I mean, just what's your sense on issues like that and whether something as fundamental as food has become politicized in this pandemic?
Yeah, well, I can just tell you from a Three Square perspective, we just won't go there. We feed everybody. We understand that federal commodities are at least planned to be declining significantly, and so we spend our energy finding alternative sources.
So what's ahead for you? Clearly, the economic recovery has been slow, and there's really no signs that the pain people are feeling will be going away anytime soon. So what does that mean for people like you?
Yeah, it does mean we're here for the long term. And so, you know what, we just gear up and we continue to meet the demand. We have an absolutely extraordinary community that rallies around us. So private industry, private individuals, foundations have just risen to the occasion far greater than I could have ever imagined. So I'm pretty proud to be a Nevada citizen, a citizen of this country, because I've seen some really great thing out of some great people.
Larry Scott, Chief Operating Officer of the Three Square Food Bank in Las Vegas, Nevada. Very busy now in the era of this pandemic. Larry, thanks for the work that you do. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced new restrictions in the United Kingdom today as the country is dealing with a surge in coronavirus cases. Health officials say there are now more people in the hospital with COVID-19 than there were in March before a national lockdown went into effect. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us. And Frank, tell us more about these new rules.
Yeah, what they're going to do is they're going to break the country into different tiers. There's going to be sort of medium, high, and very high level in terms of the coronavirus. And one thing we already know from today is that a place that's going to be put in the very high area is going to be the Liverpool City region. And this means that pubs, bars, gyms, betting shops, casinos are all going to close. And that's going to be really tough on the economy, which has been growing since we got out of lockdown, but that growth rate is slowing. And what we're going to see, I think, particularly in parts of the north of England, is communities there, governments asking for more money, more aid from the central government to get through this.
Yeah. How have businesses and local governments been responding to these new rules?
Well, I think they're not happy. I think there's also this really interesting dynamic here. The north of England is much poorer generally. I mean, there's not an exact analogy to the United States, but let's think about parts of the Rust Belt, for instance, and they look at London the way one would see New York or Silicon Valley. And so what's happening now is because the rates have been rising much faster up in the north, they're going to get hit harder sooner in this second move to really tighten restrictions. And so to them, this is especially frustrating because their economic level is so much lower. And it's an interesting dilemma for Boris Johnson because he won an election in December in part by appealing to that part of the country, which has largely been the domain of the opposition Labour Party. So now he's caught in a very difficult position. He has to put these restrictions in and actually will alienate the very people who gave him a landslide election in December.
Yes, it is interesting in light of the fact that also Prime Minister Johnson had his own very serious case of COVID-19.
He did. And since then, though, it's really interesting, Tanya, he has struggled. People thought that that case might change him a lot and make him a better, manager, governmental manager. And he really has struggled. He's come under a lot of criticism. And a lot of it isn't really political. It's more a question of actually the basic competence of the government here, especially now that we're seeing a resurgence.
NPR's Frank Langfitt speaking with us from the United Kingdom. Frank, as always, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tanya.
A national reckoning on racism has prompted many to confront their ideas about race and identity. And that not only includes outer identity, but linguistic identity as well. Here and Now producer Chico Theori has thought a lot about how she speaks and the ways others perceive it. And she has this essay.
I'm a first-generation American born of immigrant parents from Kenya. My mom and dad both moved here to receive an education, and they've been able to achieve their version of the American dream as professors. My mom teaches food and nutrition, and my dad teaches accounting. And of course, public speaking and interpersonal communication are crucial in their professions. And my parents have been doing this for decades, but my mom had some challenges at first.
When I came to the U.S., people speak with a lot of power, with a lot of loud voice. I was used to speaking low.
She spoke too softly for Americans, specifically for the Americans she met at her first teaching job at Northern Kentucky University.
And so they say, "What did you say?" I hate that.
My mom's laughing now, but she really did hate being told to speak up. As the years went by, her Kenyan accent also evolved. so much so that when she returns to Kenya, people there notice she sounds different.
I don't like that because it makes me stand out. If you're sounding like an American or sounding, your accent is like British, they equate that with, oh, this person has traveled and has lived among Americans or British. They must be of a different class. They must have more money. So if you go to the marketplace and open your mouth to start to purchase something, once they hear your accent, your price goes up.
And for that reason, whenever I'm visiting family in Kenya and we're at a market, I just keep my mouth shut. But when people there do hear me speak, they automatically revoke my Kenyan card, saying I sound like
the whites, or wazungus, as we call them here.
That's my cousin Martha.
My first impression of Shiku's accent when she spoke was very impressive and very different from how we pronounce words here in Kenya.
She's probably the first person I've ever heard describe my accent in that way, and we've struggled to communicate at times, especially when I would say particular words.
For example, she says "wara," and in Kenya, we say "water."
Growing up in the U.S. gave me a dual sense of identity. I was Kenyan at home, eating food like ugali, chapati, wearing kitenges, and occasionally mixing my mother tongue Kikuyu with English. But when I left the house, I was American. And like my mother, I too stuck out like a sore thumb. First, in the suburban Cincinnati neighborhood I grew up in, I was one of a handful of Black kids. Second, I had to help out with the pronunciation of my name again and again. But when it came to the way I spoke, I fit right in. My family would occasionally mingle with the other few African families in the area, and the only interaction I had with American kids who looked like me was at church. The Black kids there expected me to sound something like this.
I won this bronze damn Olympic medal in Beijing, China, for individual synchronized swimming. I bet you didn't even know there was a such thing as individual synchronized swimming.
And honestly, I'll never sound like NeNe Leakes in Glee, even though the show is set in Ohio.
I'm going to say one thing to you, Sam Evans, and I'm only going to say it to you once. If you pee in my pool, I will kill you.
For some reason, the white kids never flinched or made comments about the way I spoke. Maybe because I sounded like them. But the Black kids, they were very vocal about it.
Like you're an Oreo.
My college friend, Allison Johnson, says right from when I opened my mouth, they probably thought of me as different.
Like basically Black on the outside, but white on the inside, just because you talk proper. I guess like the tone of voice, your certain word choices.
During my high school years, I attended an international boarding school in Kenya. There were plenty of people from all over the world, but I was the Black American who sounded white. I was the Oreo.
If you sounded what people's stereotype of an African-American speaker is, it would be weird. Like, how did you come out that way?
This is Nicole Holliday, a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. Holliday also says the fact that I'm young and a woman who grew up in a middle-class area in the U.S. has a heavy influence on the way I speak. She says it's typical that people like me, kids of immigrants, don't interact all that much with people who speak what's considered Black American English. I ask her, what is Black American English anyway? Holliday says it links back to the fact that Black people didn't speak English when they were forcibly brought to America.
In the conditions of slavery, where they were acquiring English in this, you know, kind of unusual way, they weren't being like taught it in schools. And they were getting input from all of these different Europeans, and they had their first language. So their first languages were being influenced by the English that they were speaking. So the way that Black people were speaking in the United States has always been different than the way that most white people were speaking.
And most enslaved Africans lived in the South. But later, Black Americans started moving elsewhere across the country. This was the time of the Great Migration between 1916 and 1970. And of course, the way they spoke evolved.
And really, like, we are carrying around our ancestral experiences as well as our personal experiences in the language that we speak, too. And that's sort of something that you're getting at here.
While in college, I came to understand that Blackness meant more than American Blackness. I realized it included me, the child of immigrant parents. I met other students who grew up in American suburbs and learned to accept the fact that I didn't have to speak a certain way to be considered Black. We were Black enough. I was Black enough. And I realized that the weight of my linguistic identity may not be that significant after all. Maybe people are becoming more open to the fact that Black people are not a monolith, that we don't all speak the same way. I think we're seeing a little bit of that now as the Black Lives Matter movement continues its momentum. There are more calls for the uplifting of Black voices to share their beliefs, their experiences. But yet, when this happens, I still hear people I know react by saying, "Oh, they're so articulate," or "Wow, they speak so well."
This idea that there's a problem with sounding identifiably African-American is just racism.
If they have that preconceived prejudice, it doesn't matter how you say things or what you say, they're always going to complain.
My mom, like me, has learned to embrace her own accent. She's still teaching in the Midwest, but no longer conflicted about the way she speaks. She kicks off each semester saying this to her new students.
My accent is different. I'm not from Southern Indiana. I know that whoever listens to me speak understands exactly what I'm saying. That's when I realize it's an asset. It's what makes me me.
And I have to agree with her. The distinct way in which I speak, different from my mom and different from many other Black Americans, is what makes me, me. For Here and Now, I'm Shiko Thiuri.
And to hear a longer version of Shiko's audio essay, go to our website, hereandnow.org. As the Senate confirmation hearing for Amy Coney Barrett continues this week, Senator Dianne Feinstein, the most senior-ranking Democrat, is leading the charge to block her from becoming a Supreme Court justice. In her opening remarks today, Feinstein signaled that Democrats would focus on health care and the assumption that Judge Barrett would strike down the Affordable Care Act if confirmed.
Most importantly, health care coverage for millions of Americans is at stake with this nomination. We will examine the consequences if, and that's a big if, Republicans succeed in rushing this nomination through the Senate before the next president takes office.
But not all Democrats are confident in Senator Feinstein's role this week. And for more, let's bring in Marisa Lagos, political correspondent with KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hey, Tanya.
So we're hearing that some Democrats are privately wondering whether Senator Feinstein is the fighter they really want, going head to head with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Remind us what some of their concerns are.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that, you know, Feinstein's long been a more moderate Democrat her entire career. And so in California, progressives have always kind of lashed out at what they see as her being a little bit too bipartisan, quite frankly. But I think in recent years, there's also been a concern that maybe she is just slowing down a little bit. She's 87 years old. She, during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, met with Christine Blasey Ford ahead of time and actually kept secret some of those allegations at Christine Blasey Ford's request. But that angered Democrats, and I don't think they felt like she came into those hearings with a real strategy. And so I think that what we're hearing now is a kind of broader concern about these hearings, but also about if Democrats do retake the Senate, will she be up to the job of chairing this very powerful committee that Republicans have used very effectively during their time in power?
But at the same time, there really are limits to what one leader can do. Is there even really the sense that any of these votes are up for grabs?
No, and I think, you know, Democrats have to sort of think about what they can accomplish here. I mean, the truth is, they probably have more power in sort of what happens outside of the committee in terms of political pressure on senators of the opposite party than they might in actually convincing one of their colleagues not to vote for her nomination. But clearly this is a strategy, and I think it's important to note that it feels already just in the first few hours that there's more of a strategy here than there was at the beginning of Kavanaugh, which is to really hammer on the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, maybe that if there's a couple of vulnerable senators, I mean, they only need a few, right, that they could really kind of be speaking more directly to the American people.
Okay, so there seems to be more of a strategy than there was during the Kavanaugh hearings. But zooming out here, there is a wing of the Democratic Party that would like to see the party move in a certain direction. I mean, commit to things like ending the filibuster, something Senator Feinstein has said she's not in favor of. Can you think of a time when there's ever been a split this big within the Democratic Party?
You know, there's the generational differences, but there's also just the policy differences. And like I said, I mean, back to the time, you know, when Dianne Feinstein took over as mayor after the horrible assassinations of Harvey Milk and George Moscone, she has really struck a very moderate tone. And I think what critics of Dianne Feinstein would say is that she is kind of a bygone era that Republicans are not interested in participating in, even if some Democrats still want to preserve that time.
Hmm. Marie Salagos, political correspondent with KQED in San Francisco. As always, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tanya.
This is Here and Now. Waves of young people across the country are signing up to be poll workers this election season because many older workers who are more vulnerable to the coronavirus have decided to stay home. Election officials in the District of Columbia say more than 6,000 people, many under the age of 50, have applied to work at the polls for the first time. 23-year-old Lucas Peterzak is one of them. He's a public policy grad student at Georgetown University. Lucas, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Sure. And why did you decide to work at the polls this year?
So as you said, sort of in the introduction, as election season approached, I realized and heard some of the calls from the district that they were concerned that people in high-risk populations weren't going to be able to work at the polls this year, just for fear of contracting COVID-19, especially because you have to sit in the poll all day. So I sort of saw some stuff from the city online from the district and really spent some time thinking about it. And I've actually never worked at a poll before. Something I've thought about in the past but have never done. And I realized that I am young and healthy, and if there was any year for me to step up, this was the year to do it.
You felt like it was kind of your civic responsibility in addition to voting?
I did. Something about DC is the district is doing a very good job of providing alternatives, but at the end of the day, I still think it's really important that the polling stations are staffed and able to help anyone who wants to vote in person. And obviously, not everyone can take off Election Day, and I am privileged to be a graduate student who can take time away from my school day to work. And I thought, you know, I have the time and I have the health ability, so 2020 is my year to step up and, like you said, fulfill my civic duty to work at the station.
You know, there is some concern that as people just like you are doing this, you know, service, that, you know, if you've never done it before, that you might not be properly trained, that that might contribute to some of the problems at the polls. Can you tell us about the training that you got?
Yeah, so we actually had in-person training with the Board of Elections. They brought us down to their headquarters in Southwest D.C., and I was there from, I believe, 9 a.m. until maybe 2 in the afternoon. And the Board of Election staff was amazing. They understood that a lot of us had never done it before. But you sit through training at the beginning to talk about sort of the importance of the voting process in the district. And then we were divided up into specific jobs that we would have in the polling station on Election Day. And we first walked through it sort of verbally. And then they actually got us up and we had hands-on time with all of the elections machines, the ballot printers, the voting markers, that sort of thing. And I can tell you, when I walked out at 2 o'clock, I felt like I could be a pro at it. And they even quiz you at the end to make sure that you sort of picked up everything you need, because I think they also recognize the concern, but they definitely went over every possible question you could have imagined.
You know, you're young, 23 years old, but you're not immune to the coronavirus. How do you feel about your own safety there?
There is a slight concern, you know, especially being inside for an extended period of time. I know that's when your risk of contracting is a lot higher. But at the end of the day, somebody has to work in our polling stations. And I know that if I were to contract it, I would be able to quarantine and my immune system could easily deal with it. And so while I understand there's a chance I could walk away from Election Day with the COVID-19 positive test, it's, in my mind, worth it because the election has to happen. So why not do it as safely as possible?
Yeah. By the way, this is not a volunteer job. They're paying you, right?
I learned that during our training, actually. I did not know it when I signed up. And yes, they talked about our stipends during training. So you do get paid for working Election Day and early voting. And I believe it's about $500 for election day. And then for each early voting session you work, it's $100 with a maximum of $600.
Lucas Peterzak, first-time poll worker in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, and good luck on Election Day.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, Halloween will look very different this year across most of the country. The Centers for Disease Control are discouraging traditional trick-or-treating, which has led to some creative solutions, like one rigged up by Matt Thompson of Detroit.
It is a heavy, you know, wooden beer caddy that rides on a zip line that delivers beer to the adults, but also candy to the kids.
Thompson says he was inspired by a man in Ohio who built a candy chute in his front yard. But Thompson told us he wanted his solution to be a little more high tech.
So there is a steel cable that runs from the roof of our porch to a post I set in. And this caddy is on pulleys. And when I push it, it rolls down all the way to that post where the kids can retrieve the candy. After they've taken these things from it, I have a fishing reel hooked up to a power drill that will then retrieve the caddy and set the zip line back in place.
So I, for one, am not handy enough to build a candy zip line. So what should the rest of us do? Thomas Tsai is an assistant professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, and he joins us now. Hi, Professor.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. So the CDC has put out some guidelines for Halloween, which say that traditional trick-or-treating is considered high risk, which is like terrible news for kids across the country. Can you explain why it's risky if you stay outside the entire time?
Yeah, Peter. And it is disappointing. I think a lot of children who have been on lockdown or in virtual schooling have been looking forward to interacting with their friends during Halloween. But we have to remember we're still in the midst of a pandemic. And even though that Halloween is traditionally outdoors in terms of trick-or-treating, it still brings people into close contact and close proximity. And that does increase the risk of transmission of COVID-19.
I know a lot of people are wondering about something as simple as the candy itself. Is it a vector? So like if you were to take a piece of candy from your neighbor, should you be worried that it would be infected somehow?
On average, the risk of COVID-19 transmission from services is lower than from an airborne transmission, but the risk isn't zero. And I think it's important to think about Halloween and any other social interaction, not in absolutes of either zero risk or 100% risk. It's all really about a probability of being infected with COVID-19. So the risk isn't zero. Again, you know, with children, with runny noses, it's very easy to potentially contaminate, candy, especially when you have, potentially groups of children reaching into the same candy bowl. So we really have to be thoughtful and take precautions around that as well.
Well, to that point, I mean, the risk is also different everywhere, right? Los Angeles County, for example, recently recommended that people avoid trick-or-treating altogether because of the infection rate there. But there are other places around the country where the caseloads are much lower. Could people make a sort of case-by-case or neighborhood-by-neighborhood decision?
Yes, I think it's a balance of both the risk of the activity versus the risk level of the community-level transmission of COVID-19 in their communities. And the Harvard School of Public Health and the Harvard Global Health Institute, we have a risk-level dashboard that shows you, in terms of your own county, whether the risk of cases is green, yellow, orange, or red based on the number of actively infected individuals on a given day in that county. So in a county that is red, any of the in-person activity is a high risk, and alternatives may be a virtual trick-or-treat or even a drive-by or almost like a parade, which the CDC all consider as low-risk activities. Green areas, then, there may be the opportunity for some closer interactions, but again, the risk isn't zero.
So I hear that you have a little one who's probably a little too small to be trick-or-treating this year. But, I haven't talked to my kids yet about this, and I'm kind of dreading it because I don't know what we're going to do. But I guess, parenting advice is probably probably beyond your expertise at this point. What do you say? I mean, like, what would you tell kids?
Yeah. I have a two-year-old, and I think like every other parent in a pandemic, we're all just trying to figure it out as we go along and incorporate the best advice that's out there. You know, for our two-year-old, what we've done is, you know, the low-risk activities that the CDC recommends. So, you know, pumpkin carving and doing it on Zoom or FaceTime. So there's still a sort of group feel to it. And, you know, and on our street, we typically have a very large trick-or-treat and people have decorations out there and our neighbors have decided that that's not a good idea. So, you know, we'll sort of, you know, do a physically distanced sort of parade and people will kind of stand outside their doors and to each other. So there's still that community feel. The children will be in their costumes. There's still that level of sort of social engagement interaction, but whilst minimizing the risk.
You know, you just remind me that Halloween is one thing, but other holidays are coming up at the end of the year as well. And this is going to be relevant as much now as it is then. So Thomas Tsai, professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, thanks for your advice. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we've got more tips on celebrating Halloween safely at hereandnow.org.
Last year, Indigenous playwright Larissa Fasthorse was riding high. Her work, Thanksgiving Play, was one of the top 10 most produced works. And this year, she can add MacArthur Genius to her accomplishments. Each year, the foundation awards over $500,000 to support the work of notable people. And we're excited to welcome Fasthorse back to the show today. Hey, Larissa.
Hi, thanks for having me back. I'm thrilled to talk with you again.
Yes, so congratulations. You've had about a week to digest this honor. What was your reaction when you found out?
I honestly, well, I didn't answer the phone, as I think a lot of people don't, because we all get spam calls. Yeah. I actually thought they were calling me to employ my consulting company, Indigenous Direction. So I thought they're calling me about a job. So it took quite a while for me to get the my brain to wrap around this whole concept of getting this incredible fellowship. Now I'm still honestly trying to figure out what it means and how it's going to change our lives.
Yes, because this prize is a game changer for you. Your husband is also an artist. And I read that until recently, you were living under the poverty line here in Los Angeles, as many artists do. What has kept you going? And what does this award mean for you and your work?
Yeah, I mean, what's kept us going, I will say, is, you know, having the support of people in our fields and people believing in our work. And so that's always been incredible. I didn't get into theater for the money, and my husband didn't get into sculpture for money. You know, you do it because you love it. I think now, looking forward, it's going to be really exciting to see what happens when you take away that constant stress and pressure. We've always had the stress and pressure of how are we going to make ends meet? And when you take that away, I can't imagine what that's going to do to free our creativity, to not always have in the back of your mind, yeah, but will this pay the bills? Can I make rent this month?
When we spoke about this time last year, we were discussing the great success of Thanksgiving Play, which is a satirical take on the whiteness of the U.S. Thanksgiving narrative and the limits of political correctness. What else have you been working on?
I've had a lot of things going on. I've been fortunate since we spoke that I've been working a lot more in film and television. And what's exciting is that Hollywood is now in the place where theater was 10 years ago when I went into theater, where Hollywood really wants to try to get it right. And I think they're really making efforts to do things in a good way. They're letting me hire consultants from Indigenous communities that we're writing about, not just to say, you know, a rubber stamp on something, but to actually be involved in the full process from the very beginning of the writing all the way through the production. And that's really exciting to me because they're paying these people and respecting them and giving them a voice in a way that theater has been doing.
You mentioned that Hollywood is where theater was 10 years ago. What is the future of theater in this pandemic moment, and will it have to change?
Yeah, theater is changing in the way it's being presented at this moment. It's being changing in the way that it's looking at how these institutions have been created and how they're supported, because we're realizing it's kind of a house of cards that's very fragile, and something like this shutdown is really causing a huge, huge problem for so many theater companies and then also the people who work in them. The exciting thing that I've been hearing a lot of is how many theaters are really looking at what is our place in our local community? How are we working with local people and local artists and different folks that maybe have not been a part of our theater because we're not traveling and we're not flying people in from New York and LA and wherever, we're looking at our own hometown and how we connect to those people one-on-one. And that's really exciting. And I think the more we can do that, the more we can stop looking to the coasts and just look at where we are and the land we're on, the more exciting things are going to come out of theater in the next 10 years that we've never seen before.
Hmm. You've said that one of your talents is to be sort of a translator that helps white audiences make sense of Native experiences. Do you still see yourself that way? And can you say more on what this work of translation actually means?
I think people don't realize how far, and maybe COVID has helped some people see this, how far Indigenous peoples are from white mainstream society. You know, COVID hit Indigenous communities incredibly hard. They don't have the healthcare they need. They don't have the resources they need. All of those things came to light. And I think people are starting to get that, which is exciting. So maybe I won't have to do quite as much translating. And that would be exciting to me. That would be the goal, is that my translation skills become unnecessary. I hope we're getting closer. You know, I know it seems like right now in a lot of ways we're getting farther apart, but I think some things we're starting to realize need to change, like today, where it's Indigenous Peoples Day when we're speaking. And that's becoming more and more common. More and more people are understanding how important it is to recognize that day.
Yes, as you mentioned, it is Indigenous Peoples Day in many places in this country, but it's also Columbus Day in many other parts. What would you ask our listeners to reflect on or to do to observe this day?
Well, always, I think I even said this last time we spoke, but always know whose land you're standing on. Who are the original people of that land? You need to find that out. You need to know who those people are and where are they? Are they still there? If not, why not? Where have they gone? Start to learn, start to educate yourself. Whose land are you profiting from and how can you start to pay that back in your own way?
That's Larissa Fasthorse, playwright and 2020 MacArthur Genius Fellow. Thank you, and again, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
House lawmakers recently called for an overhaul of antitrust laws to rein in bad business practices at Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. That's next time on Here and Now.